Hi there. What we're going to do is get ready to start on a visualization, and we're going to encourage people to relax and to lie down. And so perhaps you could begin now to lie down and to close your eyes and to put aside anything that's in your hands to make sure that you're warm.
From KCRW, this is Here Be Monsters. Now, for a long time, my girlfriend's been working for an independent scholar named Lynn Gerber. Lynn studies the religious responses to AIDS in the 1980s and 90s in San Francisco. And so recently, my girlfriend was in San Francisco at an archive digging through old cassette tapes, and she found an unusual one. The tape is called Visualizing Death and Dying, and it's a recorded session from a conference that happened in 1987. The conference was for religious leaders who wanted to find better ways to help the members of their congregations who were HIV positive. And so in this tape, there are a bunch of people lying on the floor in the dark, imagining the scenes told by the facilitator. The facilitator is from a kind of new agey organization called the Shanti Project. And over the course of the next half hour, he'll guide us through the experience of dying from AIDS. And I'll also talk a little bit with Lynn Gerber about the places where queerness, religion, fear, and dying all overlap. Okay, enjoy the show.
What I'm going to be asking you to do is to try to drop this conference and simply go on an extended journey, on a voyage that I'm going to take you on. And that voyage is going to suggest to you that you could be diagnosed with AIDS. Some people cry, some people don't cry. It may be difficult for you to imagine, especially perhaps the women, to imagine that you could be diagnosed with AIDS, or heterosexuals, it's hard for you to imagine that you could be diagnosed with AIDS. So if, as I speak about the symptoms of AIDS, coming onto you and you have difficulty visualizing yourself having that happen to you, you could perhaps imagine cancer. So I'm going to encourage you to feel as safe as possible. And that's why I've come to the back of the room here, so that we have as few distracting noises as possible and we can relax as much as possible. And if in the process of this visualization you find yourself getting jammed, just keep going. Just keep going however you can to the next stage. Try to listen to me and try to move along as I move along through this exercise. So as you lie on the floor or sit in a chair, make yourself as comfortable as you can and gently close your eyes and begin to notice your breathing. Breathing in, breathing out.
Scientists at the National Centers for Disease Control in Atlanta today released the results of a study which shows that the lifestyle of some male homosexuals has triggered an epidemic of a rare form of cancer.
The condition severely weakens the body's ability to fight disease. Many victims get a rare form of cancer called Kaposi's sarcoma. One third have died and none have been cured.
Breathing in and breathing out. You can feel your belly rise and fall with each breath.
This is what the HTLV-3 virus looks like, magnified thousands of times. Clumped on the edge of a white blood cell, it's invaded. Still closer, an individual virus, showing its dense center that distinguishes it from other viruses.
Fully half of San Francisco's 80,000 gay men already may carry the AIDS antibody. Since 1981, there have been 1,400 AIDS deaths here.
And if you listen closely, you can even hear your own heart beating as you become more and more relaxed.
While gays were gaining in the courts and legislatures, a new disease was diminishing their numbers. AIDS, still incurable, still pervasive among homosexuals. This month, the total number of Americans killed by AIDS will top the number of Americans killed in Vietnam.
More delays on AIDS discrimination. No more delays on equal justice for lesbians and gay men. No more delays.
And you can continue to hear the sound of my voice as you let go and relax. Breathing in. Breathing out.
Here Be Monsters, the podcast about
anxious despair in his voice.
The podcast about
the unknown.
Lynn, could you introduce yourself?
I'm Lynn Gerber. I'm a scholar of American religion, and I research religious responses to AIDS in San Francisco in the 80s and 90s.
So what was 1987 like?
I remember 1987 as a really closeted time, or I guess I'm thinking more specifically about 1986, like my last year in high school. And if it was spoken, it really was with a real hint of utter titillation and scandal. And I remember when I first went to college, I went to the lesbian, gay, bisexual, I don't think there was a T then, student group. And it felt like going to AA when the anonymous part really fucking mattered. You know, that's what it felt like. And it felt like a huge risk to go because you could be publicly identified, and it felt kind of shocking. And it felt really important to me, even though I don't think I could have articulated why then. Yeah, but it felt important to be there.
How did you find out about AIDS?
Well, so I grew up in New York in the 80s, and New York was really the place where AIDS really took off. It felt like it was always very, very, very close and always very, very possible. And part of that was because people had no idea in the early years how it was transmitted. Could you get it from a table? Can you get it from a dish? Can you get it from a glass? Could you get it from touch or kissing? Who knew? And there was this thing out there that could get you. And even after they had identified the virus, there was still so much misinformation and confusion. And then in religious settings, there was this real interest on the part of some people, not all people, but some people, about using the threat of AIDS as a way to enforce a conservative kind of sexual morality and sexual practice, particularly among teenagers. You could sort of see those strands starting to expand and develop, that would become things like abstinence-only education maybe 2 or 3 years after I graduated from high school. So I can't remember an exact moment that was like, this is the moment that I learned about AIDS, but I do very distinctly remember that there was a before and after, that it felt to me like the world changed, that there was something about sex and there was something about life that had changed.
Reverend Falwell, you say AIDS is God's judgment on homosexual promiscuity.
I believe that God does not judge people, God judges sin. God, who loves people, hates sin and deals, whether it's a drug addict or an alcoholic or someone who's living promiscuously as far as his or her moral life is concerned, we pay the price when we violate the laws of God.
The gay rights community faces its biggest challenge as the Supreme Court hears argument today on laws in Georgia and about half the states that prohibit anal and oral sex.
We know to a certainty that AIDS is transmitted in great measure by homosexual conduct. The thought of removing that statute from the books, which prohibits homosexual conduct, does not seem all that timely to me.
As I begin to lead you on this guided journey, you may find, as I describe various situations, that you can actually picture what is happening, or that you may sense yourself there feeling what it is like. Take this opportunity to go a little deeper, to risk a little more in experiencing what you are feeling, knowing that you will only go as far as you are ready to go, and it is possible to go a little deeper, knowing that you are in a safe place. You can make the choice to come out of or enter back into the exercise whenever you want. Now, from a calm and relaxed place inside of yourself, I would like you to begin to imagine the following. Several weeks ago, you noticed a small purplish spot on your right leg. At first, you thought it looked like a bruise. It didn't itch like an insect bite. It reminded you of pictures you had seen of Kaposi's lesions. A growing sense of worry and concern came over you. You decided to make an appointment with your doctor to settle the question. During your examination, your doctor found several swollen lymph glands. Biopsies and tests of the glands were done. And imagine what it is like waiting in the doctor's office and examination rooms. Four days later, the nurse calls you and says, "We have the results of the tests, and the doctor would like to see you." Now you are sitting in your doctor's office and wondering what the test results will determine. It seems that the usually friendly receptionist at the desk is avoiding your look. What do you feel as the doctor enters, says hello, and proceeds to inform you that you have a severe case of Kaposi's sarcoma? You have AIDS.
In 1987, if you were diagnosed with HIV and AIDS, like, what was your prognosis?
The short answer is probably about 18 months to 2 years is a ballpark, but I think it really varied.
Your doctor says that you have many internal lesions. Your doctor tells you of your chances to live 1 year at most, all with the overtone of anxious despair in his voice. Do you respond to your doctor before you leave his office? You begin the often painful process of telling the significant people in your life. How do people respond to your illness and your diagnosis? Your family, your children, your friends, your roommates, your coworkers. One by one, picture each significant person in your life and imagine their response to learning that you have AIDS. Who will most likely be close to you at this time? And who will be most afraid and withdraw from you? Who will be most open to you and your needs? Picture your parents, your brothers and your sisters, your children, your lover, your friends. What feelings do you have about each person as you imagine them drawing closer or pulling away?
I previously didn't realize that there was such an intersection between AIDS, Christianity, and the New Age movements. I guess they seem like odd bedfellows. How did that happen?
Well, so there's a lot of counterculture, spirituality, New Age stuff that had been happening in the Bay Area for decades. I mean, in 1978 is the release of this book called Creative Visualization by this woman named Shakti Gawain, who lived in Marin, which became one of the best-selling books on visualization and is really a model for something like that Shanti visualization. I mean, visualization was the bread and butter of a group like Shanti from the very beginning. I mean, the earliest things that you read about happening in Shanti support groups are people going on visualizations or being led on visualizations to imagine their own health, to imagine their immune systems being restored, to imagine their cancers disappearing, because early on they thought it was a kind of cancer. They didn't totally get it was an immune disease. So they're visualizing their healing. And there's this sort of just geographic proximity of the gay world and the sort of countercultural, metaphysical, spiritual world happening in the Bay Area. And then gay men were certainly a population who were very alienated from traditional medicine, because until maybe 15 years before this, homosexuality was considered a disease. It was a mental illness. You could be diagnosed and hospitalized for being an open and practicing homosexual. So there's a lot of institutional mistrust between these communities. And then you get something like AIDS, where the stakes of it were so high because people died so fast and in such an ugly manner, and there was no stopping it. And there seemed to be no great rush to figure this thing out, to give real medical treatment, to investigate alternatives, to do something that would make this stop. So the appeal of something when there's nothing and the stakes are so high, people just threw everything at the wall to see that it would stick. And if it was spiritual healing, great. If it was Pentecostal healing, great. If it was vitamin C, great. If it was ribavir and an isoprenosone, great. If it was AZT, great. Just throw anything at it and see what the hell is going to stop this thing.
Time passes. 4 months have passed. By the time the pneumocystis pneumonia is effectively treated, you have 80 lesions on the surface of your body. Many of those lesions are on your face. You sometimes feel that people look more at your lesions than at you. Despite your ongoing attempts to stay positive, at times you feel it's too much to bear. How do you deal with that helpless part of you? While you're in the hospital, you wake up one morning feeling confused and disorientated. The last few days are full of vague recollections of painful procedures. You wonder what's been happening to you. What do you feel as you ponder this question? What's going to happen next?
Yeah, because I'm tempted to ask you, is it even possible to visualize AIDS? Like, are you able to understand this experience without actually contracting AIDS or HIV? You know, it's like, that's the question I'm tempted to ask, but also like looking at the flip side of that coin, that idea where we just ignore it, we just pretend like it isn't there. Like, I rarely think that shoving things under the rugs makes them better. So I don't know, like, I feel at a loss here.
Yeah, I think it's one of those real binds. Like, can you ever imagine something like that that you have not experienced? Probably not. Are there problems in trying to? Absolutely. But do you want to live in a world where people aren't trying to stretch their imaginations to try and understand experiences that are fundamentally different from theirs? I don't know if I want to live in that world either, you know?
Yeah.
This effort, I'm sure, has its flaws, and it certainly had its critics. Like, there was a bit of a suspicion that there was a kind of weird spiritual charge that people got from being in the proximity of death and dying and suffering, that some people really resented and were deeply suspicious of for understandable reason. And I can imagine a situation
on that point, are you saying that there was suspicion that people associated with Shanti were enjoying the proximity to death?
Well, I wouldn't say specifically about Shanti, although there's certainly suspicion. But if you look at the literature on AIDS in San Francisco over the years, you see it pop up in relation to a number of different organizations, that the religious interest in AIDS had a certain kind of prurience about it, a certain kind of spiritual prurience, that people both liked to build their own sense of spiritual selves by withstanding their exposure to other people's suffering and death, that there was something spiritually valiant about it, and that they were using people with AIDS to have that kind of experience, that there was some kind of charge, some kind of getting off on that kind of proximity that made certain groups and certain people just suspicious to certain people with AIDS. So there was a real critique. Yeah, getting their spiritual kicks out of being close to death and dying. And I mean, but I imagine this visualization is both like the exemplar of what they're talking about, of that criticism, like silently linger over the possibilities of AIDS being in your body. You know, that there's a luxuriating in it in a way that's a little unseemly. And on the other hand, like part of this is like basic human potential stuff. Like if you repress something, it becomes stronger. So visualization is a way to not repress it. It's a way to go into it. And if you go into it, you can sort of heal from it and the charge isn't as great. I can sort of see it both ways, you know?
Over a year has passed since you first heard the diagnosis of AIDS in your doctor's office. You have become progressively weaker and are now feeling very sick. You now know that there is limited time remaining to you in your life. Call each person in your life one by one into your room. Say anything you would like to say to each one. Anything that you might have left unsaid. Anything you want to repeat. Imagine each person's words to you. Then, one by one, say goodbye to all the people you love and who love you. You are feeling very tired now. Just moving seems to take monumental effort. And suddenly you begin to feel that it is time to die. Imagine yourself standing at the opening of a tunnel. Enter the tunnel and proceed at your own pace as quickly or as slowly as you like. As you go through the tunnel, try to observe what it is like and what emotions you are feeling as you go on your journey. Behind you, there is a light through which is visible a familiar scene. Doctors and nurses are working over a body, trying to bring it back to life. You see that the body was once yours. What do you feel as you observe their efforts? Do you want them to succeed? As you realize that the doctors and nurses have not been able to revive you, what do you observe being done to and with your body? Is this what you would want done? Is there a memorial service, a cremation, a burial? If there is a memorial service, what are your feelings as you listen to the words chosen to describe your life? Do you feel that they truly represent you? What do you experience as you observe the faces of the mourners and the people present at the memorial service? Is there anybody who isn't there? Now that the memorial service is at an end, what awaits you on your journey through the tunnel?
The FDA's approval of AZT today is one of the quickest approval actions on record and will make the drug available to the 14,000 AIDS victims who can be helped by it. AZT was developed in 1964 as an anti-cancer drug. But in experiments a year ago, it prolonged the lives of certain AIDS patients, those who had the weakest immune systems, and those who had pneumocystis pneumonia, a common, often fatal infection in AIDS patients. AZT did not help everyone who took it, and the drug is not a cure.
So it is a big step, but again, it's not a cure. But that's part of the process of coming forth with a cure, and hopefully other drugs will come about or vaccinations that will just complement this.
AZT is known to cause severe side effects. It can destroy bone marrow that produces blood cells, making some patients dependent on blood transfusions. Today's approval of the drug could place an enormous new burden on patients.
What happened after 1987 in terms of AIDS and religion and treatment?
AZT starts with great, great hopes. And in the next year or two, it becomes a topic of great, great, great disappointment. Some people got very sick on AZT, and it didn't buy that many people that much time. And it became a major disappointment, one of a very long line of disappointments in treatment. The thing that's really sobering is that 1987 is still really a long ways away from anything that's going to actually change the course of this epidemic for a disease that has an 18-month prognosis. I mean, that's many generations of people with AIDS dying. And it's a long time before there's a real turn of the tide.
Do you think today that there is as much crossover between AIDS and religion?
I think there's more, because there's more actual medical treatment, there's probably less reliance on things like visualization or healing, or if they're used, it's probably more as a supplement. But I think that in a moment when there's no cure and you don't even know what's happening, the field of meaning is wide open and anybody can take a stab at it. And any kind of religious group, spiritual group, political group, anything can try to come to meaning with that. And then as I think as scientific knowledge develops, the sort of plausible range of meaning making is kind of limited because you understand it better. That's that utter sense of mystery is different.
This huge quilt that today is being spread out on the Capitol Mall in Washington has 2,000 panels, every one crafted by the friends and relatives of an AIDS victim.
So we want to show the president and the Congress and the rest of the country the enormity of this epidemic. And with our quilt, we hope to show that enormity by providing people with a glimpse of the faces that are behind all of the statistics. And I think that just the image of the quilt alone says it all. We are all affected, we are all involved, and we are all part of the solution.
America is not a blanket, all one color of uncut cloth, all red, or white, or blue. America is a quilt made up of many patches, many pieces, many colors, many sizes, many textures, but everybody fits. Everybody counts. Everybody must have equal protection under the law in the real America.
This exercise is now at an end, and the picture before you is beginning to fade. As the light dims, realize that this has been an exercise. Take as much time as you need to return to your body, to this room, to the present. Take as much time as you'd like. And when you're ready, open your eyes.
My name is Jeff Entman. I produce this episode of Here Be Monsters with help from Bethany Denton. Lynn Gerber, who I interviewed, is an independent scholar, and she's currently writing a book about AIDS and religion in San Francisco. Many thanks to Ariana Nettleman for finding and sharing the cassette tape. Over on our website, hbmpodcast.com, we have a compilation of news clips about AIDS and links to a lot of the things that we only partially mentioned in this episode. Anti-sodomy laws, Jerry Falwell, the invention of antiretroviral drugs, the AIDS quilt. You know, and here's a piece of more recent news. Right before we published this episode, reports came out that a second person may have been cured of HIV. We've got a link to that too. Again, we're at hbmpodcast.com. If you would like to see me in person, talking about Here Be Monsters and sound design and deep listening and ghosts and all sorts of other things, give us a follow on Twitter at HBM Podcast. I mention this now because this spring, some people are paying me money to travel to places that I don't normally go to talk about things that I really love to talk about. So especially if you're listening from Denmark or anywhere near Winnipeg, give us a follow on Twitter and we'll post the details of those upcoming events. And if you don't live in those places but you do like this show, please do give us a rating and review wherever you listen. Maybe that's on Apple Podcasts, or maybe that's just making a public proclamation on the subway. Either of those are great. Music on this episode came from The Black Spot and Circling Lights. Here Be Monsters, that's us. We're a part of KCRW, where our senior editor is Nick White. We get additional support for freelance contributions from KCRW's independent producer project. Okay. Thanks for listening. More episodes soon.
Thank you. Well, thank you for going through this with me. Enjoy the rest of the conference.
I had a good risk.
How was it coming in a little late? Did you get
I got right into it.
Got into it?